From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, August the 8th, 2019, and we are so glad to have you listening to our program this morning. We're going to have an interesting show, I think. I'm going to hand it off to a guest host. The first half hour of the program this morning, our good friend Jack Lyons, the summer intern at WDEV, he's been doing a really excellent job here, and we decided just to hand him the controls for the next half hour or so. He's going to be, I'll let him introduce his guest, and we will have a good conversation there. And then later on, I'll be coming back in, taking over the mic, and I'll be interviewing Colonel David Smith of the Vermont National Guard. He's going to be, I think, talking with us to try to allay some of the concerns we heard about last week in an interview about the F-35 coming to the Vermont National Guard base at the Burlington International Airport. And the Guard has wanted a chance to reply to some of the criticisms raised about noise and about the possibility that some of these planes may be armed with nuclear weapons, etc. And so we'll be hearing from Colonel Smith in the second part of this hour. Later on, I believe we're going to be opening the phones and letting some listeners weigh in on whatever topics are on your mind out there, folks. Of course, you know, you're always welcome to call the program. Sometimes it's easier to take the calls than others because we just have an open phone line, etc. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury, 1-877-291-8255. And with that, I'm going to hand it off to my good friend Jack Lyons, a student at Notre Dame University. He's from South Burlington, and he is doing an excellent job for us here as a summer intern at WDEV. Take it away, Jack.
Well, thanks, Dave. Our first guest today is Jeff Thiemann. He's the president and CEO of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. They're an advocacy group dedicated to representing the state's nonprofit hospitals, and we're going to talk to him today about the future of rural hospitals in Vermont. Jeff, are you there?
I am.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on, Jack.
So I guess, no problem. So I guess our first question would be, can rural hospitals in Vermont survive over the coming decades? And, you know, what could some of the changes that take place be to enable that?
So I think first, it's a great question and a really important one for our state. And important, Jack, I think, to acknowledge right off the top that Vermont is really entirely rural. We think of rural areas and less rural areas or urban areas like Burlington, but it's really hard in a small state like ours to even separate that out. Even the teaching hospital in Burlington serves rural populations and is actively involved in coordinating care for people in rural areas throughout the state. So, and all of our other hospitals are doing that as well. So I think it's important to understand that we really are a rural state, and that rural hospitals and all of our hospitals across the state are vital in their communities, not just as caregivers, but also as big employers, often the largest employer in their community, and as community builders in the work they're doing in what we call community benefit and in health reform to try to reduce the cost of care and make it better for the patient. All of that said, rural hospitals face big challenges, as you probably know, not just here in Vermont, but across the country. We've seen rural hospital closures throughout the country in the past several years, and there's a lot of reasons that happens, but certainly cause for concern and a reason that we have our eye carefully on this. You know, there's even a task force that was created by the legislature to look into the future of rural health care in Vermont. We're represented on that task force, as are all of the other major stakeholders in our state. So this is a conversation that's well underway.
Sure. And you mentioned that all hospitals in Vermont are rural hospitals just because our state isn't very populated. But what is the difference in the challenges that are seen at, say, a small hospital like Copley Hospital in Morrisville and the challenges that are seen at UVM Medical Center in Burlington?
Yeah, so another good question. And when we looked into, when we did some research into what can happen with small rural hospitals to understand, particularly in other parts of the country, because we haven't had as many closures here in Vermont or New England, thankfully, but in trying to understand what can what can precipitate financial problems or even something as severe as a closure. There's a lot of factors that are unique to smaller rural hospitals operating in smaller communities. For example, they tend to have a lot more people on Medicare and Medicaid, and we know that those public payers for hospitals just do not reimburse at the same level, and so hospitals literally receive less income to take care of those patients, and that becomes part of the financial problem. These hospitals are often typically operating on razor-thin margins. That's certainly true here in Vermont, either razor-thin margins or as we have right now, many with negative margins. They face declining volume as population shifts to the city, and in Vermont we have an aging population. I think we're second or third in the nation as far as the age of our population. And then I think rural hospitals are also managing the challenges that are not necessarily unique to rural areas, but can be even more difficult to manage in those places, like opioid addiction and reaching out beyond the hospital walls to make sure people are healthy.
You spoke about razor-thin margins at hospitals, and I think that segues well into the conversation about rate hikes. A lot of the hospitals are feeling some pressure from the Green Mountain Care Board not to increase their rates a lot, but at the same time, they're dealing with those razor-thin margins. Can you just talk about how that bargaining works between the Green Mountain Care Board and hospitals?
Sure. I think first I would point out, as you did at the top of the show, that we are a nonprofit system. So I think we just need to always remember that when we talk about margins, those are not profit margins, but those are the margins that enable the hospital to do things like reinvest in facilities and equipment, make sure they're always providing the most modern, cutting-edge care, and that they are also, as I said, available to the community. That said, I think, Jack, that our hospitals are proposing budgets to the Green Mountain Care Board for 2020. They are proposing the budgets they need to continue meeting patient need and to continue serving their communities in an effective way, while also making sure that they are financially healthy and sustainable for the long term so that they can always be there for those communities. So the process with the Green Mountain Care Board is for those hospitals, for all of our hospitals, to present their proposed budget for next year and to have a dialogue with the Green Mountain Care Board about why the rates they've asked for are necessary to do what I just said, to make sure they continue to serve patients effectively, be there for their communities, and know that there's a sustainable plan for the future. So I think you're going to hear that dialogue take place with the Green Mountain Care Board, and hopefully our hospitals will be able to convey kind of the full set of challenges that they face. From the reimbursement issues I mentioned with Medicare and Medicaid to significant workforce challenges across our state that make healthcare both a little more expensive and challenging to deliver because we don't always have the right people in the right places and can't fill so many open slots. And also at the same time, while hospitals are managing those challenges, they're trying very hard to stay focused on health reform here in Vermont, which is really to make healthcare better for the patient by focusing on wellness instead of illness, and trying to move from a system that now pays for the number of procedures and office visits and all of that to a system that really pays for quality and outcomes and wellness. And so I think trying to do all of those things at once and keep rates low is the constant challenge, and I think our hospitals have struck the best possible balance they can, and you'll see that play out during the budget hearing later this month.
Yeah, and how much, as we're looking forward to these budget hearings, how much of a dialogue is that? I mean, is there a certain number that the Green Mountain Care Board is not going to allow, or is there a certain number that the hospital's not going to go below? You know, how does that dialogue work?
Well, the Green Mountain Care Board does set in their what they call budget guidance. They set a rate for the growth of net patient revenue, and the hospitals then propose what they think they need for their coming budget. And those differences, or if there is a difference between what the Green Mountain Care Board expects and what the hospital is proposing, then that does become a discussion as part of the hearing so that the hospital has an opportunity to explain the factors that are involved. and to try to persuade the Green Mountain Care Board that the budget that they're proposing is the one that's really needed to ensure the future of their organization and be able to serve patients the way they want to.
Gotcha. And what is, when we're talking about rate increases, what is a significant rate increase?
Well, I think, you know, it's, I would probably, rather than try to get into numbers, I think we should all acknowledge that healthcare is expensive, that there's no two ways about that, and that whether we're talking about insurance premiums or rate increases that hospitals are looking at, or we're talking about the cost of pharmaceuticals and supplies, all of the stakeholders in our system have a role to play in trying to make the system more affordable. And I think in Vermont, yes, we are encountering rate increases that, you know, premiums are expensive for people, and that is a challenge we're all trying to manage together. I think in Vermont, we're doing that in a way that's incredibly compelling and may not produce all the results we want tomorrow, but is definitely the direction that the country, that both parties believe we need to move in to really, again, focus on keeping people well, addressing the social determinants of health like housing and food security and other things that keep people healthy in the first place, and then doing a better job, Jack, on also managing chronic conditions. Once people are sick, there's a lot of technology and new patient-physician outreach that's made possible by the work we're doing here to keep people healthier and prevent emergency room visits. And all of those things eventually reduce costs while also just making life better for the patients we serve.
So you've spoken about wellness as opposed to treating wellness as opposed to illness and more sustainable long-term care provided by hospitals. I spoke yesterday with Senator Richard Westman. Mm-hmm. We tried to get him on for this segment. Unfortunately, he had a prior commitment, but I got some good background information from him. He's a board member at Copley Hospital in Morrisville, and he's also as a senator on the Health and Welfare Committee.
Right.
And he spoke about some of the things that Copley Hospital has done recently to promote what you're saying, that sustainable long-term wellness care. He talked about community health initiatives, and also they've now started doing orthopedic surgery. They invested, you know, in the short term some money on getting the infrastructure to do orthopedic surgery, and they're hoping that by offering that they can bring more patients in the door and help them do that and stay open. What other initiatives have you seen throughout the state like that are focusing on sustainable long-term care, and how essential are these to keeping rural hospitals open?
So I think you're seeing a lot of initiatives, from ones like the one like those you just described to across our hospitals. You're seeing a huge focus on expense management and always doing everything possible to minimize expenses, to join purchasing coalitions that can bring down the cost of supplies and equipment. You're seeing all of that work take place. And then I think in another important space, Jack, you're seeing really good work happening in the workforce area. So, for example, at Brattleboro Memorial Hospital, they're partnering with local nursing schools to literally help students pay for their education and get both classroom and hospital experience. It's sort of what we say, kind of grow your own, because we have a real shortage of nurses and other healthcare professionals throughout the state of Vermont, not unique to us, but certainly a problem that we're managing and that our hospitals encounter every day. And so I think partnerships with schools and trying to literally educate Vermonters in our own hospitals and being creative with partnerships with other hospitals and community organizations, that's all part of both the reform work we're doing and I think what needs to happen to help make sure we sustain our rural hospitals.
I was doing some research on this issue, and it looks like I was looking at hospital budgets changing year by year. And Springfield Hospital's budget from 2017 to 2019 jumped 9%. But the budget from 2018 to 2019, sorry, that earlier budget was from 2017 to 2018. That jumped 9%. The budget from 2018 to 2019 only jumped about 3.6%. which was lower than the average Vermont hospital for that year, 2018 to 2019. So I guess my question is, can a rural hospital survive a couple bad years if it is overall keeping up with its expenses?
Yes, I think a rural hospital can continue to be there for its patients and its community despite financial challenges. I think Springfield is a unique example because the financial challenges and obstacles have been pretty severe. They are, you know, currently working through a bankruptcy proceeding to try to emerge with a plan to ensure that they can continue to be there for patients and the community. But I think we know that in the case of Springfield, the hospital will probably, and already does in fact, look a little different. For example, we know that a hard choice they had to make was to no longer provide labor and delivery services there because it literally was not financially feasible to continue doing so. And I think what I'm really proud of, Jack, is that in order to ensure ongoing access for women in that area, Brattleboro Memorial Hospital worked with Springfield to make sure that perinatal care is still provided and that even though labor and delivery will take place at Brattleboro, which is a little ways away, people will still be able to get their routine care in the community of Springfield. So I think, you know, those challenges are the same ones I talked about for all rural hospitals, and we're still trying to understand everything that happened at Springfield, but they are building a path forward, and we'll see how that continues to evolve and develop.
Sure. And you talked about a little bit about plans to restructure for hospitals. It looks like Mount Escutney in the southern part of the state, near pretty close to Springfield, joined a network with Dartmouth-Hitchcock. Am I correct in that?
Yes, that's right.
Do you think that's an option for rural hospitals who are looking to, you know, deal with some of their financial struggles?
Absolutely. Affiliating with a larger system is an option for a smaller unaffiliated hospital to consider. Those are important community-based conversations that need to take place hospital by hospital and community by community to decide what's in the best interest of both the hospital and the community. And I think sometimes affiliations of various sizes and shapes will be appropriate and will be selected as the best option moving forward, and other times not. But it certainly is an option. Some of our hospitals, like Porter Medical Center, is part of the University of Vermont Health Network, as is Central Vermont Medical Center, and like you mentioned, Mount Escutney is part of Dartmouth. So those partnerships are there and definitely one of the options available to rural hospitals that want to consider that and move through a process to do so.
All right, we're going to head to the phones right now and bring in Ruth from Sheldon. Ruth, good morning.
Good morning. I want to talk about the Northwest Medical Center in St. Albans. They've always done an excellent job of their budget, and they have a large percentage of their patients are Medicaid and Medicare. And I think they're now in financial trouble, and I think it's probably because people can't pay their high deductibles. They want to raise the insurance rates, and people already cannot pay for their insurance, health insurance, and then pay for their deductibles. And I want to know, if you know, if this is a huge problem for all the rural hospitals in that people are not paying their high deductibles and how much this is part of the problem. Thank you.
So that's a great question. And the answer is yes, all of our hospitals, rural and otherwise, are experiencing more unpaid bills as a result of high deductibles and copays. And, you know, this is a product of the coverage side of the equation, really, where we need to make sure that we always have policies in place to make affordability possible when it comes to health insurance policies. The Affordable Care Act made great strides. Here in Vermont, we have always had very generous and thoughtful coverage policies. At the same time, they are expensive, and these policies that are affordable or more affordable from a premium standpoint can involve high deductibles. That's something that also needs to be worked on, again, in concert with all of the stakeholders, because it's a piece that does need to be addressed and part of the affordability equation, absolutely.
All right, thank you. I have another question here. What is the role that private fundraising will play in the future of rural hospitals in Vermont?
Yeah, so, you know, all of our hospitals, I think, get donations to some degree. Some of them work on that in different ways, depending on their size and scope and kind of the foundations they may or may not have set up. I don't think I see that significantly changing in the future, Jack, and I don't have numbers in front of me that could speak to sort of how that works for each hospital, but I could get you more on that if you're interested.
Yeah, thank you. I guess... you know, one of the questions that would come up is you know, a lot of people have been talking about the insurance rates going up. You know, I think Ruth and Sheldon just brought that up. What is it like on for a hospital to negotiate care costs with insurance companies when people can't pay for their health care?
So hospitals negotiate with insurance companies to determine the rate that they get paid by those insurance companies to deliver various services. When people don't pay, it's really kind of when they don't or can't pay, then they would fall into what we call the hospital's charity care policy. And those policies provide various levels of assistance to ensure that people with lower incomes get some level of protection. And those policies are posted on the hospital websites.
Okay. And this year we've been talking a lot about rate increases. Is this something that you think will continue in future years?
I do. I think, healthcare is expensive, but I also... think it's important to remember that we are doing the right work here in Vermont with what we call the all-payer model. It's our health reform program, and it's the one that I really do believe, by focusing on wellness and keeping people healthy, will really start to change the cost equation over time.
All right. Thank you, Jeff Thiemann, the president and CEO of Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, for joining us for our discussion about rural hospitals in Vermont. Stay with us on the Dave Graham Show.
I wish I had a dollar for every compliment I get about our selection upstairs at the Warren Store. This season's collection boasts country casual clothing for men and women, dresses for summer weddings and events, baby clothing from Zuchano and Doodle Pants, and fair trade jewelry from around the world. I'm excited about a new line of pottery from Londonderry, Vermont. Also, illuminated paper stars for outdoor fun. It's a great day trip to Warren Village. Come for lunch on the deck and upstairs for some unique retail therapy. Fun, funky, and friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back. It is Dave. I want to thank my good friend Jack Lyons very much for steering us through the first half hour of the program this morning. He's getting a lot of good experiences here at WDEV and tending to hit them all out of the park. He's been doing a great job on our regular news reports. He's played the part of a straight-ahead reporter, and just now he got a chance to do the radio talk show host thing, and I thought he did a fine job in his interview with Jeff Thiemann of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Health Systems in the first half hour of our program this morning. If you're just tuning in now and you missed that interview and you'd like to hear it, you can always go to our podcast. We have an excellent service there where you can listen any time of day or night to past segments and whole programs, really, of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. Go to the station's website. It is WDEVradio.com. You can follow the link from there. There's a link right on that homepage to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit when you get there, and you will find a list of our recent programs by topic and guest, and figure out what you'll want to hear. Alrighty, I want to move on to the next segment of our program now. And last week we had a doctor, I'm blanking on the first name now, Ruhr, come in talking to us about concerns that have been voiced by critics of a plan to bring F-35 fighter jets to the Vermont Air National Guard base at the Burlington International Airport. And at the time, I did try to line up someone from the Guard to come in and sort of act as a counter and give us both sides of the story that day. Couldn't schedule that right off, but decided that, well, the thing to do then is to get somebody from the Guard on the show in the subsequent days. And here we are on a subsequent day, Thursday, August the 8th, 2019. And with me this morning is Colonel David Smith, a 31-year veteran of the Vermont National Guard. And we're going to be talking with Colonel Smith about, efforts to allay concerns about the arrival of the F-35s, which actually begin next month. So let's first start out with just the outline of the plan here. Colonel Smith, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here. I really look forward to updating you and the community on where we are with respect to the F-35.
And so the planes, they made a brief cameo appearance a month or so ago,
I think.
But the real official schedule starts in September, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we're just over a month out now. We don't have the exact date solidified, but we anticipate mid-September sometime the first two F-35s will land in Burlington.
And they'll be arriving, what, two by two over subsequent months or a few at a time? Or
Yeah, basically, over essentially the next year, two by two. So roughly two airplanes a month. So, a little less than a year from now, we'll have the full complement of F-35s on base.
And how many will that be?
It's 20 total. It's an 18-aircraft squadron with 20 total airplanes.
Okay. So the two are like subs or?
Two are just with normal maintenance procedures. The two are just to flow into the normal training schedule and planned maintenance and things like that.
And these replace the F-16s, which have been a feature of the local life up in the Burlington area for a long time now.
They do. The F-16s we flew proudly for 33 years. I remember when I was at UVM is when we got the airplanes, and they've been part of of our base, certainly in our mission in the community for the last three decades. And just back in April, the last four F-16s departed. So we have no airplanes right now.
I saw in your bio that Lieutenant Clark, Chelsea Clark, the public relations person for the Vermont National Guard, kindly shared with me that you actually have been an F-16 pilot. You must have had little pangs of nostalgia or whatever when the last of the F-16s flew off in April, right?
I did. When you think about events that we've had, celebrations, that was, in my career, probably the best one I was ever at. We had our community there, our retirees were there, our members were there, their families, and we really celebrated what it took to, safely and professionally maintain and fly that really outstanding airplane for 33 years. And we all gathered on the flight line to watch the last four airplanes leave, and there were tears in the crowd, a lot of nostalgia, and it's we're really proud of what we do. We're proud of I'm proud of the whole, all our airmen and families in the community. It's taken a real community effort to do this and this flying mission, certainly with the F-16s, for more than 30 years.
Yeah, that is a long tour for those, that particular plane. So as I say, they have been the thing, the sort of leading feature, I guess, in some ways, of the Vermont Air National Guard's activities up there. And so and now you have the summer where you're basically in this interregnum period between the F-16s and the F-35s, what's going on up there this summer? Are things a little too quiet?
Yeah, it's interesting. Having a flying mission, you get into the daily operations with that. It's really busy, and so not having airplanes since April, it's definitely different. Our airmen like to be working and on airplanes and flying airplanes and other parts of the base that support that mission. So really, what our focus has been. It's been for the last nearly 10 years, but this specifically this summer is just doing the final touches on the base from a facility perspective to be ready for the F-35s to land, and also a training perspective to make sure that our airmen individually are ready for when that day happens. We already have nearly 50 airmen that are already qualified to work on the F-35. We have pilots that are already flying the F-35 at different locations. And now it's a matter of those folks the majority of those folks are back home, and it's getting the wing ready in preparations for the first two airplanes to land. Because really, once they land, we really kick into gear to train up the rest of the base to be ready for this new mission.
There will be different maintenance aspects. Obviously, these planes are significantly different in some of their aspects, right?
Yeah, they are. At its foundation, it's an airplane. And there's a pilot in it, and there's maintenance professionals that maintain it and support teams that maintain it. But there are differences. There's some new career fields with the F-35. Some of the legacy or the F-16 career fields have gone away and been replaced. So, and just the way the overall, it's still, you know, parts, you know, and supply and maintenance actions, but the way the program is managed logistically is slightly different. It's a, so it, that's new, but, you know, to me at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's wrenches and it's, you know, turning and launching and recovering airplanes and fixing them and maintaining a fleet health, which we're really, really good at.
And have the airmen been, and airwomen, I don't know if that's the term of art, but...
We refer to them as airmen.
Yeah, okay. Are folks going elsewhere for training, or is the training coming to the base in Burlington, or yeah, what's the...
That's a great question. It's a little of both. You know, we had the foresight a few years ago to send almost 50 airmen out, back onto active duty, so they actually left the Guard and went back on active duty, and we're at roughly a half a dozen F-35 bases around the country to get qualified on and work on the F-35 for over 3 years. And those airmen are back. So we have folks that have left the base to train. We also have some hands-on training that's happening with folks, some of our airmen that have gone to school and then gone to an F-35 base to get hands-on training. And then the big movement for the wing is essentially immediately after the airplanes land here in September, about 200 of our airmen will be go through what's called a field training team, and that's where F-35 qualified instructors will come onto the base, and for 90 days, right through the end of the calendar year, we'll train the base on the specifics of F-35 actions across multiple career fields. And then beyond that, we keep our folks and get them on what's called seasoning days to really top off the final training. So it's a combination of both on-base and off-base training.
244-1777 is our local number here in Waterbury. If listeners out there would like to call with any questions for Colonel David Smith of the Vermont National Guard, and the toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. This is your chance. If you have questions or comments you would like the Colonel to hear, and don't be shy out there, folks. Now, I wanted to ask you, Colonel, obviously there have been some concerns, as we mentioned, voiced about the arrival of the F-35s in Burlington. One of them has to do with noise, and they do have a bigger noise footprint than the F-16s, right? Is that right?
Well, if a document that's really worth reading, and it's very extensive, is the Environmental Impact Statement. And if you look at that, it'll say that the F-35 is generally a louder airplane. So there's a lot of information in that that I encourage people to read. One of the things that I would say is, you know, when I've been around fighter aviation for over 30 years now, certainly with the F-16 a long time, and then just some of my deployments, I've been around every single fighter aircraft. And I'll tell you, from a noise perspective, you know, when we had four F-35s divert into Burlington back at the end of May, and I stood at the, you know, where the airplanes were running and alongside the runway when they took off, from my experience, it was a fighter airplane taking off out of Burlington. And I think it's important that, that our community educates themselves on the Environmental Impact Statement and then really determines for themselves, you know, what the impact is. I understand, and we're fully aware that, you know, flying fighter airplanes out of Burlington has an impact on the community. And we continue to look at our flying operations to how can we best mitigate our impact. Because as community members, I mean, we're right there with everybody else. So it's really important to us that we work with the community. We work closely with the airport team there to really minimize and mitigate our noise impact to the community.
So nothing on that day when you heard them take it off made you say, holy cow, that's a different animal.
It made me really excited, actually, when they landed. There was a lot of energy on the base. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've heard the F-35 before, but I wanted to hear them on the base, and we weren't planning on that event to happen. I was curious to see, okay, they're going to take off out of Burlington with a power setting that we're going to use when we're flying it. And, I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, I was surprised. That experience I thought was very reflective of an F-16 taking off that we've had for so many years.
Let's go to a caller. Jennifer from South Burlington is on the line. Good morning, Jennifer.
Hi. I live about a mile and a half from the airport, and I'm outside of the so-called noise impact zone, and I heard it loud and clear in my neighborhood the day that it took off. And based on research, we know that it is four times louder than the F-16. There was even an article in the Popular Mechanics that came out this week about the noise impacts. And other research shows us that the F-35 is eight times the crash risk, and it's coming in over a highly populated area. Also, originally, the Air Force didn't want to base it here because they knew it would put civilians at risk. So my question is, why is the Vermont Air National Guard supporting a project that puts civilians at risk when their role is to protect us? We know that our homes aren't yet retrofitted, so I'm glad that the Guards people will be getting the training and preparation they need, but the civilian population near the airport and in the entire region is not yet prepared for this. So how can it be that this is the proper timing for such a project, and it's most certainly not the right location for it?
You're raising a lot of issues here. I want to get into them one by one here, or at least some of them. And one of the things I think you said was that there's a crash risk that's 8 times higher with the F-35 than with the F-16. Is that the claim?
That's based on research. It's because of the concurrency issues with the way the plane was developed. And I really hope that you're doing the same research and looking at the...
Where is that? What is the research? I mean, what have you been?
The project on government oversight and other organizations have looked into the fact that because this plane was patched together during a period where there was so much technological innovation, there's all types of systems on the plane, and it's not fully tested. So it's beginning to be based here before it's entirely tested.
Let me bring in Colonel Smith and ask you, Colonel, what about this worry that these planes are have 8 times the crash risk of what we've seen before?
Yeah, no, I mean, I know, here's what I know for sure. The F-35 has been flying for over 10 years. There's been over 400 airplanes delivered and have flown over 200,000 hours. And I'm not sure where the data, what the source is for the 8 times crash risk, but that's certainly not what I've seen. When I look at the current, and I'm talking Air Force because it's an Air Force, because, you know, the models of airplanes matter. So there's 3 variants of the F-35. So the A model is what's coming to Vermont. When I look at the accident rate or, you know, on that, it's very similar to the accident rate of the or mishap rate of the F-16 over its lifetime. So I certainly haven't seen or I'm aware of any data that supports that there's an 8 times crash risk. I just I don't believe that is true. I'm not sure where that data comes from. You know, with respect to noise, I'll say just what I said before. We're going to continue to work to minimize our impact. And with respect to the basing decision was made back in 2013 through a very thorough and deliberate environmental impact statement and Secretary of the Air Force basing decision. So that decision was made after a lot of, you know, scoping meetings and public forums.
Colonel, do you know how many bases around the country are housing the F-35s right now?
I do. The F-35 is flying at 19 bases globally.
Globally,
there's
8
countries that are involved in the program, and it's a real global program. And like I said, there's over 400 airplanes and over 800 pilots and 8,000 maintenance professionals that have been trained. And I think, you know, when you look at the F-35, and I've received questions, I mean, the F-35 is the fighter aircraft to replace the F-15, the F-16, the A-10. F-18 and number of fourth generation, we call it older fighters. So when you look out 20 years, the Air Force is buying over 1,700 F-35s, and they're going to be at Air Force bases and Guard units, and the Guard will make up about half of the operational squadrons in the Air Force. So they're going to be at communities all around the country.
Are they being based in mainly in populated areas or in less populated areas?
Well, I think that's a challenge, frankly, from even the remote Air Force bases that I was at as a young officer are now more populated. And certainly when you look at the Air National Guard, who's a full partner and with concurrent fielding as the Air Force, I mean, Guard bases are built primarily on joint use airfields. They're at international airports at, you know, large cities. Look across the country, you know, Houston, Texas, Jacksonville, Florida, Madison, Wisconsin, who's the preferred alternative for the next round of Air National Guard basing. So F-35s will be at populated areas. They already are. They're at, you know, Valparaiso and Eglin, Florida. They're in Phoenix, Arizona. That's a huge metropolitan area, and there's over 100 airplanes there. So it's going to be part of the Air Force's fighter inventory for decades.
And is there what is the mishap record like with the F-35s? I've seen, I guess I'd say, mixed reports.
Well, when you look at the you know, mishap data is based on different things. It's based on a value. So when you say crashes, it's the way the Air Force tracks mishaps. It's not specifically crashes. There's it could be engine damage to you know, a bird going down the engine, and it's based on a value. So you know, what the Air Force, it's all based on per 100,000 flying hours. And like I said earlier, it's very similar to what the F-16 is. And the environmental impact will tell you that historically, to the caller's point, that accident rates are higher early on in with new airplanes. But when you look at the F-35, that's certainly not what I've seen, and not what the data shows. And you know, it's got a very similar rate right now to the history of the F-16. And I'll also add, you know, when you look at our unit, you know, for our period flying the F-16 for 33 years, our safety rate was 4 times better than the F-16 safety rate across the Air Force over the same period. And that's to boast a little bit, but it's also a real tribute to the skill and the professionalism of our airmen. We have a lot of experience in the Guard from our pilot cadre and our airmen, and it makes a really, really big difference. And we saw that with the F-16, and I'm really confident we'll see that with the F-35. The F-35 is a really capable, very safe airplane, and it's shown that in its first 10 years of flight.
We are down to the last few minutes here, and I want to make sure we get one question answered, which we haven't gotten to yet. And then we'll talk to Nils from Duxbury. Colonel David Smith is my guest. He's with the Vermont Air National Guard up in the Burlington International Airport. That's where the base is. And we're talking about the arrival beginning next month of the F-35 fighter jets, which are, according to some reports, capable of being armed with nuclear weapons. And Colonel, that is a concern to some Vermonters who have been, fairly late in the review process here, really have tried to raise that as an issue. What should they be thinking?
Yeah, no, I understand the concerns, but you know what we've said and publicly and through media releases and things is our F-35s do not have a nuclear mission. So we've said that, and that is that we don't. So when you look at the Vermont Air National Guard, the F-35s we're getting do not have a nuclear mission. We don't have the hardware for that, and we don't have plans to make them that way. So that's, you know, that's the answer to that question is.
So no, that's really not a worry then, is what you're saying. I mean, anybody who's concerned about that should just not be. Is that the answer?
Yes.
Okay, let's go to Nils in Duxbury. Nils, good morning.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I want to appreciate the previous caller and the points she made. I guess the polite word is sandbagging, so I'm going to give you both another example. Years ago, BTV switched from VFR to IFR, both ends of that runway. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, I had loud jet traffic over my place. Really loud, like wake up in the middle of the night loud.
In Duxbury?
That's right. So I called and spoke to Guard folks, and they said, well, you know, we follow FAA guidelines and what to do with the people in the tower. Tell us.
Nils, I need to cut you off because I got to get a quick response from Colonel Smith.
Well, it turned out to be baloney because the FAA said the same thing. Oh, no, the Guard tells us how they want to fly.
Unfortunately, we are about out of time here for this segment of the Dave Graham Show. I wish we'd made it a longer one. Hey, Colonel Smith, David Smith of the Vermont Air National Guard, thanks so much for joining me this morning. I really appreciate you coming down.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Really proud of the men and women and where we are right now and excited for what's happening.
Got to go to some CBS News at the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. Stay with us for the second hour. We'll be back in a few minutes.
I wish I had a dollar for every compliment I get about our selection upstairs at the Warren Store. This season's collection boasts country casual clothing for men and women, dresses for summer weddings and events, baby clothing from Zucciano and Doodle Pants, and fair trade jewelry from around the world. I'm excited about a new line of pottery from Londonderry, Vermont. Also, illuminated paper stars for outdoor fun. It's a great day trip to Warren Village. Come for lunch on the deck and upstairs for some unique retail therapy. Fun, funky, and friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back for the second hour of our program on this August the 8th, 2019, Thursday morning. And I wanted to take another minute here with Colonel David Smith of the Vermont Air National Guard because we got a question from Nils in Duxbury right at the top of the hour there. And we had to go to news and it didn't really have a chance for the Colonel to address the concerns voiced by the caller. And Colonel, I'm glad you could stay with us another minute or two and just He seemed to be concerned that because of changes in instrumentation at the airport, there's a flight path that goes right over his house in Duxbury, and he's not liking it much. What's going on here?
Yeah, and I think it was a little cut out just with the transition there, but I think I got the gist of the question. You know, I flew the F-16 for 25 years in Burlington and saw a lot, you know, instrument approach changes, and I think what Nils is, if I got the pronunciation right, is hearing is, you know, in inclement weather and at night, if the active runway is landing to the north, runway 33, the instrument approach procedure, and it's published, it's not by our choice, it's what the procedure is, brings us almost right over Camel's Hump. When you're on the approach, if it's good weather, you look off your right wing, and then Camel's Hump is right there. So you're 20, 25 miles, almost 30 miles south, coming in on a really long straight-in approach, and I'm assuming that the caller's home is probably on that approach, and that's also approach that civilian airplanes fly as well. So I'm pretty sure that's what he's hearing, and that's really driven by, you know, our using that approach is driven by weather and darkness, frankly, for safety.
I think Nils may be back with us. Are you, Nils?
Thank you. To clarify what I was trying to say, that description is completely accurate, commercial as well as private and military stuff flies up right up above. The point I was trying to make is when I got in touch with the light colonels at the Guard and talked to them, they would say, well, two things. They would say, we fly as quietly as we can, and the FAA tells us what to do. The guys in the tower at BTV are giving us our approach spec, and that's what we follow. When I got in touch with the FAA, they said, oh, no, the Guard tells us what they want to do, and we produce the paperwork and what have you to let them come and go, as they say. So my take from that is I wasn't getting a straight answer from the Guard, and I wasn't getting a straight answer from the FAA. And that's why I come up with the term sandbagging. There's probably less polite terms for it. But at that moment, and this goes back 16 or 17 years, I got in touch with our congressional delegation, and they were completely, absolutely no help at all. And despite the fact that I probably voted for them all.
Okay.
And I realized that even the top management at VTANG wasn't being honest. Their claim that they attempt to be good neighbors, in my view, is not backed up by their activity and the way they carry on. That's all I have to say. Thanks for listening.
Okay, thank you for the call. One last thought, Colonel.
Yeah, no. We are actually being honest, and what I would say to your question, I think there was one in there, was it really depends. So sometimes we ask the air traffic control specifically how we want to fly into the airport, but in your situation, if it's inclement weather or night, we're radar vectored to very specific points on that instrument approach procedure for safety that we're vectored onto, and the air traffic control does it. So it's really a combination. We do fly the airplane as quietly and to mitigate our impact as best we can to the community. And we fly. Sometimes we were able to ask for specific procedures. Sometimes the air traffic control dictates it. So it's a combination, but there was no dishonesty in our responses.
All right. On that, I'm going to have to change our topic here. We've got Bob Ney from Talk Media News on the line. I do want to get to Bob. Thank you very much, Colonel, for coming in. I really appreciate it. Colonel David Smith of the Vermont Air National Guard, and he has been our guest for this last half hour or so on the Dave Graham Show. Let's change over now to our good friend Bob Ney from, as I mentioned, from Talk Media News. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. We've been having a little conversation about both military and civilian air traffic into our Burlington International Airport up here in Vermont. So, if you were
really
curious what we were talking about, that's the subject. Anyway, I wanted to change over here to your presentation, which, and you all, as I mentioned, you very kindly send me an email that shows up early in the morning, tells me a little bit about what we're talking about. It looks like a couple of the Democratic candidates are maybe raising us. It started out with white nationalist, and now we're going straight to white supremacist. This is charges against President Trump for Beto O'Rourke and Senator Elizabeth Warren. And anybody else piling on by now?
Well, no. I mean, Joe Biden has said some things about the, you know, president is stirring things up and about race and things, but the two hardest hitting, from what I've seen so far of the 20, is definitely Elizabeth Warren and Beto O'Rourke. And, of course, Beto O'Rourke is at 2-some percent. Elizabeth Warren's, you know, higher in the polling. And I only mention that because sometimes when the 1% or 2%, as we're calling them, people say something, that's sort of like, okay, they're saying something just to get up there. But Elizabeth Warren obviously has a lot of points and stature within the Democratic constituency. So, yeah, they came out pretty hard-hitting. Of course, the president, you know, being the president, will punch back. I haven't seen that much back at Elizabeth Warren, but I did with Beto O'Rourke. The president made fun of his name, the nickname Beto, which is a Spanish, I think, Latino name.
For Roberto. His first name is actually Robert. And of course, he's, and I think he gets a little bit of cred that goes beyond maybe the 1 or 2% wherever he is at the polls, because he is actually from El Paso. So this is
from that aspect. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So then you tell us why it matters. Several 2020 candidates have denounced Trump for racism, but the comments of Warren and O'Rourke mark the strongest condemnation yet of Trump and his divisive rhetoric and anti-immigration policies. I guess they're sort of the leading edge of this thing right now, then. Is that right?
Well, they are of this. Of course, Biden, like I said, Biden has also said some things, and every Democratic candidate is going to be naturally asked. And you know how the president is. He leaves nothing unanswered. He will go back at every single thing. Yep. Even when sometimes he should let things go, you know, he won't. Now, on these, I don't think he's obviously going to let things go, or would, you know, with what they're saying. So he's going to hit back at them.
Not his style.
When all the dust settles on this, though, the issue is out there of gun legislation and what happens with it.
Yeah, and that is sort of the other aspect of this thing, is what will change, if anything, on the ground. You can argue all day about the degree to which the president is a racist or a white supremacist or whatever. Uh-huh. His defenders will say neither is true. I think if you look at the record of his activities and statements going back to the 1970s, when he was sued as a landlord in New York for refusing to rent to people of color, and then, of course, the Central Park jogger case, and all these different utterances as president, equating counter protesters with the white neo Nazis who were marching on Charlottesville just a couple of years ago, on and on. I mean, it seems like there's an awfully long record there for someone who wants to claim not to be a white supremacist or a racist. But anyway, your take on this right now is that. What is likely, is anything likely to happen on, for instance, gun control legislation?
Well, here's what's going to make it fascinating. If you look at, I don't claim to have known Trump, because I don't, but I do know people that have worked, obviously for President Trump, and you try to learn a little bit about the psyche of the person. I think we all know his psyche now, how he kind of operates. But if you look at his history, look, he was not the Republican choice. If you say conservatives and Republican, you say Ted Cruz, or Lindsey Graham. You don't say, you really don't even say Jeb Bush, but you don't say Donald Trump for sure. And Trump's had a history of certain things. At the convention, he came out for LGBTQ rights right at the podium. I was there in the convention and heard him. And then the gun lobby and also people, who support the Second Amendment and are against gun control, whichever way you want to frame it, they've all been originally suspicious of Trump because he's a New Yorker, And I heard that he was being criticized today by some within the NRA because he's coming out and talking about background checks and things. So my bottom line to that is, I think he is pliable on certain things. I think he is. And I think if the Congress acts, that they may get some receptivity to this issue, because, again, he's not a forever dyed-in-the-wool, Second Amendment guy. Now, if you want to compare him, this is what the right will tell you, if you want to compare him to Elizabeth Warren, I can't say Bernie Sanders, he's had a different record, but Elizabeth Warren or something on the issue, then Trump's going to be a big Second Amendment person. But in all reality, he may sign some things.
Yeah, that's interesting. Of course, something would have to come up out of the Congress, meaning getting past.
Oh, absolutely.
Past
he's
Mitch
not
McConnell.
Started.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
right.
and that may be where the roadblock would be on this kind of stuff right now.
Well, I think so. But then again, they have 22 seats open. You have Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, This has happened in his home state, Dayton, Ohio. This puts a lot of pressure on people to do something.
Yeah. Now, Trump's going after the mayor of Dayton, I guess, now. Is that right?
Yeah, this one I really didn't. Well, there's a couple things I didn't get. First of all, Senator Sherrod Brown, I have known for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
I served with even three different capacities. I've known Sherrod forever. And so Sherrod said some things, that could irritate the president. And Sherrod made a couple of blanket statements again that could cause the two of them to go back and forth, right? When I watched the mayor's statements, I'm like, okay, there wasn't really a lot to pick from there, you know, to start a fight with, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And that's number one. So I don't know why he came out so harsh on her. She wasn't that bad towards him. Sherrod wasn't the worst in the world. He just said a few things here and there that, you know, definitely the president could fight him on. The second part to it, though, it would have served the president so much better had he just, I'm not saying don't respond to things, but had he just said, wow, when the press asked him, he'd just say, that's so political on a day like this, I'm not even going to address it.
Can you imagine such a thing, though? Donald Trump saying, I'm not going to.
No, we would have all passed. You and I would have spent an entire your show on talking about it today. Right.
We'd be for weeks. Yeah, it would be like, oh, my word, is Donald Trump calming down? You know,
that somebody has captured the president, kidnapped him and replaced him.
Yeah.
But he could have, and it would have been just so much better. But, yeah, I thought his swipes at the mayor was, I thought, what did she do? You know. I didn't think it was that bad.
Hey, Bob, you know, I'm hearing this increasing drumbeat from Republicans who really resent their guy being called a racist, because obviously then if they vote for him, you know, that it opens up the question, uh-huh. Is somebody who votes for him racist? And what do you think of this as a possible response to that whole conundrum?
I don't think everybody should get labeled. Look, I have relatives who would crawl across glass for Hillary Clinton.
Uh-huh.
I mean, literally, they would have. And they campaigned for her and everything. And I used to tell them, because they would say, you know, everybody is a homophobic, white, racist that voted for the president. And, you know, I would tell them there's a whole wide variety of people that voted, including 49% of women. And I was telling her, whether she likes, you know, my relatives, whether they like to hear it or not, Antifa has a thesis to it of violence is okay, or, you know, aggression is okay if it's for the right cause, you know. And I was just saying to her, you can't equate people who are supporting Hillary Clinton, who happen to be in Antifa, that everybody is out to actually cause violence, and they all Hillary Clinton supporters are like that, you know. There's a wide variety of people that are supporting people. So I think the deplorable comment, for example, they're deplorables. That really hurt Hillary.
Yeah, it did.
Quite a lot.
It did. But, I mean, I just wonder, would it be smart or would it be useful for somebody in the Republican Party to say, let's put up an alternative candidate and to run against Trump in the primaries. And that way, if you're really concerned about this, if you're worried about Trump's racism, you know, you have a place to go. It doesn't mean you necessarily have to support the Democrat. But I mean, let's think about because I mean the continuation. I think a lot of people thought once Trump became president, you know, when he was going through the election, wow, he's elected. There's a surprise, and then there's that couple month period, you know, the lame duck period or whatever, and people I think sort of had this expectation that he would rise to the occasion to be president. But it's been since he was president that he said things about Charlottesville, and he said things about majority black countries being assholes and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he clearly hasn't risen to some new level just by virtue of being elected president. So maybe at this point you say, no, the guy really is who he is, and we knew it all along. We shouldn't have expected any change when he got elected, you know, actually got to the White House. Now we know. And so then you're really faced with the question even more clearly than you were in 2016. Now we know how the guy behaves as president, and it's still very problematic. And shouldn't it be the case now where Republicans say, okay, let's bring out this guy, John Huntsman, who just got done being ambassador to Russia because he was tired.
Well, let me throw out John Kasich.
John Kasich.
Ohio governor.
I think a lot of people consider Bill Weld a little bit of lightweight or something, but I mean, there are other Republicans out there who could take the party's mantle, you know, small government and conservative values or whatever, without this baggage of, you know, calling Mexicans rapists and all this. And then people could support the Republican candidate without having to deal with this question of what does that say about me? Am I, even if I'm not racist, what am I willing to throw all people of color under the bus because I like his economic policy? I mean, what's up with that?
Well, I mean, the reason I think you can't have that scenario happen is this. You know, I mean, Bill Weld's running, but, you know, he left the party, turned libertarian, you know, and now he's running again. That's not, you know, way up there. But like if you had a John Kasich, the problem you've got is nobody wants to run against Trump.
Yeah, I really wish somebody would muster up the courage. Because
like John Kasich, I keep mentioning him. He ran against Trump once. He's not governor anymore. A lot of people were asking John to run. He doesn't want to run.
Yeah. add me to the list, John Kasich.
Yeah,
I'm also asking you to run or somebody. You know, and I know, you know, people accuse me of just being the liberal who wants the most liberal Republican or whatever. I would go for Ted Cruz again as the Republican nomination on him if he could get in there and enable the party to lose this racial baggage. I mean, that's what it needs to do. It really needs
to. Well, I got you beat. I've been accused of being a Bernie Sanders shill, and I've been accused of being a right-wing guy. So I've been accused on both sides of the spectrum.
That's why we love you, Bob. you heard it yesterday. You heard this guy Rama call in and accused me and you of being way too mamby-pamby conservative or something. Next guy who called in was accusing me of being, you know, too anti-Trump.
So you're doing something okay.
Yeah, that's why we get along so well. We take hits from both sides, so it's all a good thing.
Right.
Hey, Bob, I appreciate it once again, let's keep having these conversations. They're a lot of fun. All righty. We're going to open the phone lines for the balance of the program this morning and invite listeners to call in and share your thoughts about what's been going on in here in Vermont and in the nation at large, the world at large. Anything you want to talk about, we're opening it up for the remainder of the program this morning. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury, 1-877-291-8255. And I was just looking at the Washington Post's website. They've got a lead story up right now, which is quite interesting. It talks about two U.S. senators, Cory Booker, who, of course, is a presidential candidate, and Richard Durbin. Durbin is from Illinois. Both are Democrats. And on Thursday, they implored the FBI and Justice Department to address the threat of white nationalism. With the level of intensity the agencies, these being the FBI and the Justice Department, with the level of intensity those agencies gave to international terrorism following 9/11. And I wonder whether listeners out there see the current threat as on par with what was happening, the way the country felt after the September 11th attacks, 2001. And of course, you know, you roll your memory back 18 years, and we were in a period of really serious national anguish, I think, after those attacks. And are we about there now? Is this another period where we're really scratching our heads and trying to figure out what's the best path forward for the United States of America? How do we respond to the threats that are coming at us? It appears that, at least in some instances, the threats that are coming at us are born right here in this country. And it's quite concerning. Let's see here. I'm going to continue reading from this Washington Post story. It's quite interesting. A letter from the lawmakers addressed to Attorney General William Barr and FBI Director Christopher Wray follows two mass shootings last weekend in Texas and Ohio that left 31 dead and dozens more wounded. In the letter, the senators decry a, quote, growing, unquote, domestic terrorism threat and noted one of the attacks was reportedly carried out by a, quote, white man motivated by racist and anti-immigrant hatred. This, of course, was the guy in El Paso who investigators found had posted an online manifesto specifically attacking verbally in Hispanics, talking about an invasion of Texas by folks from south of the border. And the that word invasion, of course, has been much quoted this week because it was the exact word that President Trump himself has used on more than one occasion to describe immigration from south of the border into the United States of America. And, you know, if you actually think that this is an invasion, oftentimes invasions are responded to with firearms. I mean, that's what militaries do when their countries are being invaded. That's how wars start and so on and so forth. And apparently there are some Americans out there who feel like the immigration situation in our southern border has risen to that level. And then the next thing that happens is somebody goes out and decides that if these people are invaders, we better start shooting them. In fact, those words were uttered at a rally with President Trump, a political rally he held several weeks back. And it was in Florida, and his response was to sort of chuckle and say, you can get away with saying that in the panhandle. and I'm not sure whether that's the proper response for a president of the United States to say, to sort of laugh something like that off. In another world, you might see a president say, we do not condone violence, and we seriously hope that nobody is seriously thinking about shooting people. That's not the way it's supposed to work in the United States of America. You go through, maybe you get arrested for illegal immigration, but you go through a deportation process and legal processes as opposed to being shot randomly on the street. That's just not the way it's supposed to work. Hey, we're going to be back with more of the Dave Graham Show shortly. We're going to be doing some CBS News at the bottom of the hour. We are going to be hearing some words from our sponsors and then back with your calls in a few minutes.
I wish I had a dollar for every compliment I get about our selection upstairs at the Warren Store. This season's collection boasts country casual clothing for men and women, dresses for summer weddings and events, baby clothing from Zuchano and Doodle Pants, and fair trade jewelry from around the world. I'm excited about a new line of pottery from Londonderry, Vermont. Also, illuminated paper stars for outdoor fun. It's a great day trip to Warren Village. Come for lunch on the deck and upstairs for some unique retail therapy. Fun, funky, and friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Yeah, we were talking about this letter from Senators Cory Booker and Dick Durbin. Booker, of course, is a senator from New Jersey. These are both Democrats. Booker's a candidate for president. He's one of the 20 or so that have been participating in the recent presidential Democratic presidential debates. Dick Durbin is a veteran U.S. senator from Illinois, and they have written to Christopher Wray, the head of the FBI, and to William Barr, the attorney general, to ask them what the government can do to step up its investigations and its general posture regarding white supremacist, they call terrorism, in the United States of America. And they actually are arguing that this is a similar situation to what the nation faced after the 9/11 attacks of course, 2001. And one of the things that the letter says is I'll just read some of the text here. It is clear that violent white supremacists are the most significant domestic terrorism threat facing our nation today. And as far as we can tell, this is to Barr now, as far as we can tell, you have not uttered a single word in public about this grave threat to American security since you became our nation's top law enforcement officer. So I'm wondering if listeners out there think that William Barr, the Attorney General, has a duty to address this issue and to talk about what the Justice Department, the FBI, are doing or need to do to step up their surveillance, their vigilance, their general posture about addressing this domestic terrorism, this born of really of white supremacy and racism in the United States. The Washington Post here, which is talking about this, goes on to say Thursday's letter comes more than 3 months after a slew of Democratic senators, including Booker and two other 2020 presidential candidates, wrote a similar message to Barr and Wray, calling on the FBI to amend how it classified domestic terrorist incidents. The May 2nd letter slammed the FBI for implementing a new category called racially motivated violent extremism. which combined white supremacist acts with, quote, black identity extremists, unquote. In both letters, the senator argued the new categorization downplayed white supremacy. They said the phrase, quote, black identity extremists was fabricated based on, quote, a faulty assessment of a small number of isolated incidents, unquote, and urged the FBI to specifically track white supremacist acts. So that's an interesting development there, where the administration wants to lump these white supremacist acts together with something called black identity extremist acts. And the senators are saying there just aren't many of these in this other category here. There's not much of that going on in the United States of America. The real problem is white supremacist acts, and the FBI and the Justice Department need to get serious about those and not divert our attention onto this other category. I guess they want to attribute to black folks, and it turns out there's just not much happening there. So if your house is on fire, you probably want to put out that fire and not worry about your neighbor's house right now, which is not burning. Just a thought. I'd be curious to know what you think out there, listeners. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number, 1-877-291-8255. And the I think it's an interesting development to see this question raised to our government, to the government agencies primarily responsible for enforcing laws against terrorism, those being the FBI for starters, the Justice Department. What are they doing? How can they possibly respond better than they are now to white domestic terrorism? And these are seem to be real issues in this country. Obviously, that guy in El Paso, people are saying that the shooting in Dayton, Ohio, was perpetrated by somebody who had expressed leftist views online, although there was no direct tie between that anybody could has been able to determine so far that, you know, if the guy is a supporter of Elizabeth Warren, which I've seen reported in a couple of places, that necessarily is what prompted his act of shooting. One of the people he shot was his sister, I think raising the question in some people's minds as to whether there was some sort of domestic violence stuff going on here of some sort or another. So there's no clear link there between ideology and the heinous act in Dayton, Ohio that there is in the El Paso shooting, where the guy specifically posted this manifesto online before the El Paso shooting, using the word invasion, the same word the president has used to describe immigration. And so there's much more of a much stronger sort of ideological link in the El Paso shooting so far been established. I mean, maybe continuing investigations will find something different. But then it is, seems to be the case in the Dayton shooting. Very interesting non-parallel there. I think people need to keep their eye on the differences here. Here's an interesting story. This is Huffington Post reporting. Republican group attacks Trump and Mitch McConnell in new ad running on Fox News. I got to get my head around this for a moment here, folks. This is a Republican group attacking the Republican president and the Republican majority leader of the United States Senate in a new ad running on on Fox News. And this is kind of an interesting thing here. This new spot warns about the election security threat and urges the Senate to act. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is getting hit by members of his own party in a new TV ad airing Thursday in Washington, D.C. and in his home state of Kentucky. The spot urges voters to call McConnell and demand a vote on the election security bills he blocked last week. It also features a supercut of President Donald Trump dismissing the well-documented threat of election interference from Russia. The ad will run on, quote, Morning Joe, on MSNBC, and during Fox and Friends on Fox News in D.C. The latter is known to be one of Trump's favorite shows. Former Weekly Standard editor Bill Kristol shared the post, which was created by Republicans for the Rule of Law, an organization of which he is a director. And this is interesting stuff here, and it kind of goes to this idea that has been percolating in my own mind for the last couple of days. There are some Republicans out there who have never been real warm about their president, Donald Trump, and I think that the recent developments of Trump's statements, his incendiary remarks about those four congresswomen of color, for example, and other. Is the whole string of stuff, you know, the Charlottesville comments, the right all the way back to his campaign, and of course even earlier in his life, these indications, and as I was saying earlier with in our conversation with Bob Ney, I think I was saying that I think a lot of folks kind of hoped that the president would tone down some of this rhetoric after he got elected, and okay, he's going to the White House now. The president of the United States, a big part of the job description there is that you get the world's biggest bully pulpit. When you speak, people really listen to you carefully, and you have a heck of a lot of influence just by your words. Words do matter, and when they're the president's words, you know, despite all we talk about equality, et cetera, in the United States, the president's words matter more than anybody else's. Let's face facts here, folks. And so when the president of the United States continues to talk from time to time about, you know, majority black countries being assholes and all these other remarks, I don't need to recite them all again, that the president of the United States has made even since being elected, you do have to ask yourself whether Republicans might be wise to find somebody who doesn't have all this baggage to run for president, challenge him in the primaries in 2020. And so now we see this Republican group involving Bill Kristol and others saying, let's get after the president about election security issues. Let's get after Mitch McConnell. And of course, election security legislation has been bottled up by the Senate in no small thanks to the majority leader. And the this Huffington Post piece says the bills which are aimed at helping to protect against Russian meddling and other threats include a $775 million measure passed by the House to strengthen state election systems. McConnell claimed the bills were unnecessary and said that Trump had already taken action to protect elections. The ad also contains comments by Trump in which he not only claims Russia isn't a threat, but admits he'd take dirt on a rival if Moscow offered it. Quote, "It's not an interference," Trump said on ABC in an ABC interview in June. "They have information. I think I'd take it." So, This of course, is pretty interesting because, you know, one of the real questions of the whole Mueller investigation of the 2016 election was this, centered around this allegation that the Trump campaign did take negative information about Hillary Clinton from the Russians. And so here we have the president of the United States coming out after this two-year investigation into this whole thing, saying that basically there's no problem there. I would do it. I would do it again. They have information. I think I'd take it, is the quote from President Trump in this ABC interview. Back to the Huffington Post, critics slammed McConnell for blocking the bills. Quote, "He is aiding and abetting Russian President Vladimir Putin's ongoing attempts to subvert American democracy, according to the Republican FBI, CIA, DIA, Intel Committee," Joe Scarborough said on his MSNBC news show. "All Republicans are all saying Russia is subverting American democracy, and Moscow Mitch won't even let the Senate take a vote on that. That is un-American." That is according to Joe Scarborough, former Republican congressman from Florida, by the way. And that's pretty funny. I mean, I hear from some of our callers here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM that I'm too liberal and I'm too anti-Trump. And here's Joe Scarborough, former Republican congressman from Florida, saying some pretty harsh things about the president of the United States. Just curious to know whether listeners out there have any thoughts on whether the FBI and the Justice Department need to step up and start investigating more rigorously, more thoroughly, and more aggressively the idea that there may be a lot of more potential attacks out there, domestic terrorism brought on especially by white supremacists in the United States of America. White supremacists used to be a fairly rare thing, we thought, in the United States. Now we have, of course, a couple of United States senators referring to the president of the United States as a white supremacist. I'm sorry, one United States senator, one former congressman from Texas, Beto O'Rourke, and Elizabeth Warren, two candidates in the Democratic primary race, both using that term, white supremacist, to describe the president of the United States. Is that overdone? Are they being a little over the top with that terminology, or is that an accurate description of the president? What do you think out there, folks? Give a call to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. You can weigh in on that question. Meanwhile, in Mississippi yesterday, there were a series of raids by ICE and, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement conducted 7 raids at food processing plants across Mississippi. A lot of these they basically process chickens is one of the big things they do down there at these food processing plants in Mississippi. And the 680 people taken into custody, of course, were largely undocumented Hispanic immigrants working in the oftentimes very difficult and no fun conditions of these chicken processing plants in Mississippi. I'm still trying to figure out to what degree any of the employers of these folks who absolutely are violating federal law if they are employing people who are undocumented and don't have the proper work visas, et cetera. To what extent were they arrested? That is an important question. Let's see. USA Today has a story here. A Scott County child started kindergarten Wednesday, while a child was at school. Their parent was arrested by federal agents, one of 680 people taken into custody after U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement conducted 7 raids at food processing plants across Mississippi. School Superintendent Tony McGee said as of Wednesday afternoon he knew of at least 6 families within the district that had had a parent caught up in the raids. The students range from kindergarten to high school. So here's the picture I think it's being painted here. This is something to try to get your mind around here. It's a Wednesday morning in Mississippi. Apparently they start the school year there, as I think they do in other parts of the country, earlier than in Vermont. So kids are just starting the school year. And here's a kid going off to kindergarten. And while the kid is at school, first day of kindergarten, the parent gets arrested. And now is the kid going to be able to go home and be treated to his or her afternoon milk and cookies or whatever would be part of a routine for a kindergartner coming home from school? Or will the parent just not be there? And if so, who supervises this child? What is going to happen with not just this child, but apparently several others in this particular school where Superintendent Tony McGee said he knew of at least 6 families within the district that had a parent caught up in the raids. The students range from kindergarten to high school. McGee, who met with ICE officials after the raids, said he expected the number to increase. The raids happened in small towns near Jackson, that's the state capital, with a workforce made up largely Latino immigrants. And reports from the scene of the raids mentioned children waving goodbye to their parents as the adults were taken into custody. It is not publicly known how many children are being affected by the arrests. And, you do have to ask the question, is this the right way to handle our immigration issue in the United States of America? To have kids go to school in the morning and essentially lose their parents while they're in their kindergarten classes at the school. In Scott County, teachers and staff are on standby to make sure a child doesn't go home to an empty house. Bus drivers have been given strict instructions to have, quote, a visual reference to a parent or guardian, unquote, before they drop the student off. If there's not a parent home, the child will be taken back to school. Okay, so is the school equipped now? The school normally shuts down at, 3 in the afternoon or something. And teachers go home and staff want to go home at the end of the day. Where's the child going to sleep that night? Apparently some churches are stepping up. But was all this stuff thought through before these raids were carried out? And here's a quote. We're going to be here at the school until we make sure that every child is home safe or has a safe place to go. This is, again, Superintendent McGee of the local school district where these raids are going down. We're going to make sure that our kids are taken care of first. And, you know, that sounds like a noble and warranted sentiment from a school superintendent. One hopes that the school superintendent would respond in such a fashion. And the question is always from there, okay, so what are the logistics here? Does the school superintendent actually have the support he or she needs to carry out that sentiment and that that idea that you're going to want to make sure the kids are safe and they're taken care of, et cetera? And again, did anybody who decided to pull off this raid think about this stuff ahead of time? Or did they just say, immigrants working here, undocumented immigrants, bad, let's go round them up? I don't know. I don't know the answer to this question. It could be that this is all very well planned out here. But anyway, on and on we go. This is just another manifestation of the inability of the United States to come up with an immigration policy that actually seems workable and fair. And, you know, people, to those who want to accuse me of favoring open borders or whatever, I don't think just opening the border is the way to go either. But I do think that we need to actually respond to what the needs are of people who are showing up down there and figure out how we do handle it in a rational and humane way. And so far, that doesn't seem to be happening. Well, we'll stay on top of it here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. We are about at the top of the hour, which means the end of the program for today. I appreciate everybody tuning in and listening. And it's we're going to do this again, actually, tomorrow from the Vermont Antique and Classic Car Show on Farfield in Waterbury, first of a three-day weekend car event, antiques, classic cars. It's going to be a lot of fun. Tune in tomorrow for that. And meanwhile, stay tuned for the Bill Sayre Show, Common Sense Radio. And have a great afternoon, everybody.